Nanny was helped in, eventually, and had to have things explained to her.
"Three gifts, eh?" she said. "Haven't done one of them things since I was a gal. It takes me back. What are you doing?"
McGrath was bustling around the room, lighting candles. "Oh, we've got to create the right magical ambience," she explained. Granny shrugged but said nothing, even in the face of the extreme provocation. All witches did their magic their own way, and this was McGrath's house.
"What are we going to give him, then?" said Nanny.
"We're just discussing it," said Granny.
"I know what he'll want," said Nanny.
She made a suggestion, which was received in frozen silence. "I don't see what use that would be," said McGrath eventually. "Wouldn't it be rather uncomfortable?"
"He'll thank us when he grows up, you mark my words," said Nanny. "My first husband, he always said..."
"Something a bit less physical is generally the style of things,"
interrupted Granny, glaring at Nanny Ogg.
"There's no need to go and spoil everything, Gaither. Why do you always have to..."
"Well, at least I can say that I..."
Nanny began. Both voices faded to a mutter. There was a long, edgy silence.
"I think," said McGrath, with brittle brightness, "that perhaps it would be a good idea if we all go back to our little cottages and do it our own way. You know, separately. It's been a long day, and we're all rather tired."
"Good idea," said Granny firmly, and stood up. "Come, Nanny Ogg," she snapped. "It's been a long day, and we're all rather tired."
McGrath heard them bickering as they wandered down the path. She sat rather sadly amidst the coloured candles, holding a small bottle of extremely thaumaturgical incense that she had ordered from a magical supplies emporium in faraway Ankh-Morpork. She'd been rather looking forward to trying it. Sometimes, she thought, it would be nice if people could be a bit kinder. She stared at the ball. Well, she could make a start.
"He will make friends easily," she whispered.
It wasn't much, she knew, but it was something she'd never been able to get the hang of. Nanny Ogg, sitting alone in her kitchen with her huge tomcat curled up on her lap, poured herself a nightcap, and through the haze tried to remember the words of verse 17 of the hedgehog song. There was something about goats, she recalled, but the details eluded her. Time abraded memory. She toasted the invisible presence.
"A bloody good memory is what he ought to have," she said. "He'll always remember the words."
And Granny Weatherwax, striding home alone through the midnight forest, wrapped her shawl around her and considered. It had been a long day and a trying one. The theatre had been the worst part. All people pretending to be other people. Things happening that weren't real. Bits of countryside you could put your foot through. Granny liked to know where she stood, and she wasn't certain she stood for that sort of thing. The world seemed to be changing all the time. It didn't used to change so much. It was bewildering. She walked quickly through the darkness with the frank stride of someone who was at least certain that the forest, on this damp and windy night, contained strange and terrible things, and she was it.
"Let him be whoever he thinks he is," she said. "That's all anybody could hope for in this world."
Like most people, witches are unfocused in time. The difference is they dimly realize it and make use of it. They cherish the past because part of them is still living there, and they can see the shadows the future casts before it. Granny could feel the shape of the future, and it had knives in it. It began at 5 the next morning. 4 men rode through the woods near Granny's cottage, tethering the horses out of earshot, and crept very cautiously through the mists. The sergeant in charge was not happy in his work. He was a ram-tops man, and wasn't at all certain about how you went about arresting a witch. He was pretty certain, though, that the witch wouldn't like the idea. He didn't like the idea of a witch not liking the idea. The men were ram-toppers as well. They were following him very closely, ready to duck behind him at the first sign of anything more unexpected than a tree. Granny's cottage was a fungoid shape in the mist. Her unruly herb garden seemed to move, even in the still air. It contained plants seen nowhere else in the mountains, their roots and seeds traded across 5,000 miles of the Discworld, and the sergeant could swear that one or two blooms turned towards him. He shuddered.
"What now, Sarge?" We spread out," he said. "Yes, we spread out. That's what we do."
They moved carefully through the bracken. The sergeant crouched behind a handy log and said,
"Right, very good. You've got the general idea. Now, let's spread out again. And this time we spread out separately."
The men grumbled a bit, but disappeared into the mist. The sergeant gave them a few minutes to take up positions, then said,
"Right, now we..."
He paused. He wondered whether he dared shout, and decided against it. He stood up. He removed his helmet to show respect, and sidled through the damp grass to the back door. He knocked, very gently. After a wait of several seconds, he clamped his helmet back on his head and said,
"No one in. Blast!"
and started to stride away. The door opened. It opened very slowly, and with the maximum amount of creak. Simple neglect wouldn't have caused that depth of groan. You needed careful work with hot water over a period of weeks. The sergeant stopped, and then turned round very slowly, while contriving to move as few muscles as possible. He had mixed feelings about the fact that there was nothing in the doorway. In his experience, doors didn't just open themselves. He cleared his throat nervously. Granny Weatherwax, right by his ear, said,
"That's a nasty cough you've got there. You did right in coming to me."
The sergeant looked up at her with an expression of mad gratitude. He said,
"Ugh!" "She did what?"
said the Duke. The sergeant stared fixedly at an area a few inches to the right of the Duke's chair.
"She gave me a cup of tea, sir," he said. "And what about your men?" "She gave them one too, sir."
The Duke rose from his chair and put his arm around the sergeant's rustling chainmail shoulders. He was in a bad mood. He had spent half the night washing his hands. He kept thinking that something was whispering in his ear. His breakfast oatmeal had been served up too salty and roasted with an apple in it. And the cook had hysterics in the kitchen. You could tell the Duke was extremely annoyed. He was polite. The Duke was the kind of man who becomes more and more agreeable as his temper drains away, until the point is reached where the words,
"Thank you so much,"
have the cutting edge of a guillotine.
"Sergeant,"
he said, walking the man slowly across the floor.
"Sir?" "I am not sure I made your orders clear, Sergeant,"
said the Duke in snake tones.
"Sir?" "I mean, it is possible I may have confused you. I meant to say, bring me a witch in chains if necessary. But perhaps what I really said was, go and have a cup of tea. Was this in fact the case?"
The sergeant wrinkled his forehead. Sarcasm had not hitherto entered his life. His experience of people being annoyed with him generally involved shouting and occasional bits of wood.
"No, sir,"
he said.
"I wonder why, then, you did not in fact do this thing that I asked."
"Sir?" "I expect she said some magical words, did she?
I've heard about witches, said the Duke, who had spent the night before reading, until his bandaged hands shook too much, some of the more excitable works on the subject, written by wizards who are celibate and get some pretty funny ideas around 4 o'clock in the morning.
I imagine she offered you visions of unearthly delight. Did she show you...
The Duke shuddered.
Dark fascinations and forbidden raptures, the like of which mortal men should not even think of, and demonic secrets that took you to the depth of man's desires.
The Duke sat down and fanned himself with his handkerchief.
Are you all right, sir?
Said the sergeant.
What? Oh, perfectly, perfectly.
Only you've gone all red.
Don't change the subject, man,
snapped the Duke, pulling himself together.
Admit it. She offered you hedonistic and licentious pleasures known only to those who dabble in the carnal arts, didn't she?
The sergeant stood to attention and stared straight ahead.
No, sir,
he said, in the manner of one speaking the truth come what may.
She offered me a ban.
A ban?
Yes, sir, it had currants in it.
Felmet sat absolutely still while he fought for internal peace. Finally, all he could manage was...
And what did your men do about this?
They had a bun too, sir, all except young Roger, who isn't allowed fruit, sir, on account of his trouble.
The Duke sagged back on the window seat and put his hand over his eyes. I was born to rule down on the plains, he thought. Where it's all flat, and there isn't all this weather, and everything, and there are people who don't appear to be made of dough. He's going to tell me what this Roger had.
He had a biscuit, sir.
The Duke stared out at the trees. He was angry. He was extremely angry. But 20 years of marriage to Lady Felmet had taught him not simply to control his emotions, but to control his instincts as well. And not so much as the twitching of a muscle indicated the workings of his mind. Besides, arising out of the black depths of his head was an emotion that hitherto he had little time for. Curiosity was flashing a fin. The Duke had managed quite well for 50 years without finding a use for curiosity. It was not a trait much encouraged in an aristocrat. He had found certainty was a much better bet. However, it occurred to him that, for once, curiosity might have its uses. The sergeant was standing in the middle of the floor with the stolid air of one who is awaiting a word of command, and who is quite prepared so to wait until continental drift budges him from his post. He had been in the undemanding service of the kings of Lancre for many years, and it showed. His body was standing to attention. Despite all his efforts, his stomach stood at ease. The Duke's gaze fell on the fool, who was sitting on his stool by the throne. A hunched figure looked up, embarrassed, and gave his bells a half-hearted shake. The Duke reached a decision. The way to progress, he'd found, was to find weak spots. He tried to shut away the thought that these included such things as king's kidneys at the top of dark stairways, and concentrated on the matter in hand. And he'd scrubbed and scrubbed, but it seemed to have no effect. Eventually he'd gone down to the dungeons and borrowed one of the torturer's wire brushes and scrubbed with that too. That had had no effect either. It had made it worse. The harder he scrubbed, the more blood there was. He was afraid he might go mad. He wrestled the thought to the back of his mind. Weak spots, that was it. The fool looked all weak spot.
You may go, sergeant.
Sir,
said the sergeant, and marched out stiffly.
Fool?
Marry, sir, said the fool nervously. He gave his hated medallion a quick strum. The Duke sat down on the throne.
I am already extremely married, he said. Advise me, my fool.
I' faith, nuncle, said the fool.
Nor am I thy nuncle. I feel sure I would have remembered,
said Lord Felmet,
leaning down until the prow of his nose was a few inches from the fool's stricken face.
"If you preface your next remark with Nuncle, Faith, or Mary, it will go hard with you."
The fool moved his lips silently and then said, "How do you feel about Prithee?" The Duke knew when to allow some slack.
"Prithee I can live with," he said. "So can you, but no capering."
He grinned encouragingly.
"How long have you been a fool, boy?"
"Prithee, sirrah."
"The sirrah," said the Duke, holding up a hand. "On the whole, I think not."
"Prithee, sirrah, sirrah," said the fool, and swallowed nervously. "All my life, sir. 17 years under the bladder, man and boy, and my father before me, and my nuncle at the same time as him, and my grandad before them, and his—"
"Your whole family have been fools?"
"Family tradition, sir," said the fool. The Duke smiled again, and the fool was too worried to notice how many teeth it contained.
"You come from these parts, don't you?"
said the Duke. "Yes, sir."
"So you would know all about the natives' beliefs and so on?"
"I suppose so, sir. Prithee?"
"Good. Where do you sleep, my fool?"
"In the stable, sir."
"From now on you may sleep in the corridor outside my room," said the Duke, beneficently.
"Gosh!"
"And now,"
said the Duke, his voice dripping across the fool like treacle over a pudding,
"tell me about witches."
That night the fool slept on good royal flagstones in the whistling corridor above the great hall instead of the warm, stuffy straw of the stables. "This is foolish," he told himself. "Mary, but is it foolish enough?" He dozed off fitfully, into some sort of dream where a vague figure kept trying to attract his attention, and was only dimly aware of the voices of Lord and Lady Filmot on the other side of the door.
"It's suddenly a lot less draughty,"
said the Duchess grudgingly. The Duke sat back in the armchair and smiled at his wife.
"Well?"
she demanded.
"Where are the witches?"
"The Chamberlain would appear to be right, beloved. The witches seem to have the local people in thrall. The sergeant of the guard came back empty-handed."
"Handed." He came down heavily on the importunate thought.
"You must have him executed,"
she said promptly,
"to make an example to the others."
"A course of action, my dear, which ultimately results in us ordering the last soldier to cut his own throat as an example to himself. By the way," he added mildly, "there would appear to be somewhat fewer servants around the place. You know I would not normally interfere."
"Then don't,"
she snapped.
"Housekeeping is under my control. I cannot abide slackness."
"I'm sure you know best, but
what of these witches? Will you stand idly by and let trouble seed for the future? Will you let these witches defy you? What of the crown?"
The Duke shrugged.
"No doubt it ended in the river," he said.
"And the child? He was given to the witches. Did they do human sacrifice?"
"It would appear not," said the Duke.
The Duchess looked vaguely disappointed.
"These witches," said the Duke, "apparently they seem to cast a spell on people."
"Well, obviously."
"Not like a magic spell. They seem to be respected. They do medicine and so on. It's rather strange. The mountain people seem to be afraid of them and proud of them at the same time. It might be a little difficult to move against them."
"I could come to believe," said the Duchess darkly,
that they have cast a glamour over you as well.
In fact, the Duke was intrigued. Power was always darkly fascinating, which was why he had married the Duchess in the first place. He stared fixedly at the fire.
In fact,
said the Duchess, who recognized the malign smile,
you like it, don't you? The thought of the danger. I remember when we were married, all that business with the knotted rope.
She snapped her fingers in front of the Duke's glazed eyes. He sat up.
Not at all,
he shouted.
Then what will you do?
Wait.
Wait?
Wait and consider. Patience is a virtue.
The Duke sat back. The smile he smiled could have spent a million years sitting on a rock. And then, just below one eye, he started to twitch. Blood was oozing between the bandages on his hand. Once again the full moon rode the clouds. Granny Weatherwax milked and fed the goats, banked the fire, put a cloth over the mirror, and pulled her broomstick out from behind the door. She went out, locked the back door behind her, and hung the key on its nail in the privy. This was quite sufficient. Only once in the entire history of witchery in Ramtops had a thief broken into a witch's cottage. The witch concerned visited the most terrible punishment on him. She did nothing, although sometimes when she saw him in the village she'd smile in a faint, puzzled way. After 3 weeks of this, the suspense was too much for him, and he took his own life. In fact, he took it all the way across the continent, where he became a reformed character and never went home again. Granny sat on the broom and muttered a few words, but without much conviction. After a further couple of tries she got off, fiddled with the binding, and had another go. There was a suspicion of glitter from one end of the stick, which quickly died away.
Drat, she said under her breath.
She looked around carefully in case anyone was watching. In fact, it was only a hunting badger who, hearing the thumping of running feet, poked its head out of the bushes and saw Granny hurtling down the path with a broomstick held stiff-armed beside her. At last the magic caught, and she managed to vault clumsily onto it before it trundled into the night sky as graceful as a duck with one wing missing. From above the trees came a muffled curse against all dwarfish mechanics. Most witches preferred to live in isolated cottages with the traditional curly chimneys and weed-grown thatch. Granny Weatherwax approved of this. It was no good being a witch unless you let people know. Nanny Ogg didn't much care about what people knew, and even less for what they thought, and lived in a new, knick-knack crammed cottage in the middle of Loncra Town itself, and at the heart of her own private empire. Various daughters and daughters-in-law came in to cook and clean on a sort of rota. Every flat surface was stuffed with ornaments brought back by far-travelling members of the family. Sons and grandsons kept the log pile stacked. The roof shingled. The chimney swept. The drinks cabinet was always full. The pouch by her rocking chair always stuffed with tobacco. Above the hearth was a huge pokerwork sign saying, Mother. No tyrant in the whole history of the world had ever achieved a domination so complete. Nanny Ogg also kept a cat. A huge one-eyed grey tom called Grebo, who divided his time between sleeping, eating, and fathering the most enormous incestuous feline tribe. He opened his eye like a yellow window into hell when he heard Granny's broomstick land awkwardly on the back lawn. With the instinct of his kind, he recognized Granny as an inveterate cat hater and oozed gently under a chair. McGrath was already seated primly by the fire. It is one of the few unbendable rules of magic that its practitioners cannot change their own appearance for any length of time. Their bodies develop a kind of morphic inertia and gradually return to their original shape. But McGrath tried. Every morning her hair was long, thick, and blonde, but by the evening it had always returned to its normal, worried frizz. To ameliorate the effect, she had to try to plait violets and cowslips in it. The result was not all she had hoped. It gave the impression that a window box had fallen on her head.
"Good evening," said Granny.
"Well met by moonlight," said McGrath politely. "Merry meet. A star shines on..."
"Watch her,"
said Nanny Ogg. McGrath winced. Granny sat down and started removing the hatpins that nailed her tall hat to her bun. Finally, the sight of McGrath dawned on her.
"McGrath!"
The young witch jumped and clamped her knuckly hands to the virtuous frontage of her gown.
"Yes?"
she quavered.
"What have you got on your lap?"
"It's my familiar," she said defensively.
"What happened to that toad you had?"
"It wandered off," muttered McGrath. "Anyway, it wasn't very good."
Granny sighed. McGrath's desperate search for a reliable familiar had been going on for some time, and despite the love and attention she lavished on them, they all seemed to have some terrible flaw, such as a tendency to bite, get trodden on, or, in extreme cases, metamorphose.
"That makes 15 this year," said Granny, "not counting the horse. What's this one?"
"It's a rock,"
chuckled Nanny Ogg.
"Well, at least it should last," said Granny.
The rock extended a head and gave her a look of mild amusement.
"It's a tortoise," said McGrath. "I bought it down in Sheepbridge Market. It's incredibly old and knows many secrets," the man said.
"I know that man," said Granny. "He's the one who sells goldfish that tarnish after a day or two."
"Anyway, I shall call him Lightfoot," said McGrath, her voice warm with defiance. "I can if I want."
"Yes, yes, all right, I'm sure," said Granny. "Anyway, how goes it, sisters? It's 2 months since last we met."
"It should be every new moon," said McGrath sternly. "Regular."
"It was our Graham's youngest's wedding," said Nanny Ogg. "Couldn't miss it." "And I was up all night with a sick goat," said Granny Weatherwax promptly.
"Yes, well," said McGrath doubtfully. She rummaged in her bag. "Anyway, if we're going to start, we'd better light the candles."
The senior witches exchanged a resigned glance.
"But we've got this lovely new lamp our Tracy sent me," said Nanny Ogg innocently. "And I was going to poke up the fire a bit." "I have excellent night vision, McGrath," said Nanny sternly. "And you've been reading them funny books. Grimmers."
"Grimoires."
"You ain't going to draw on the floor again, neither," warned Nanny Ogg. "It took our dream days to clear up after those what's-names last time."
"Runes," said McGrath. There was a look of pleading in her eyes. "Look, just one candle."
"All right," said Nanny Ogg, relenting a bit. "If it makes you feel any better, just the one, mind. And a decent white one, nothing fancy."
McGrath sighed. It probably wasn't a good idea to bring out the rest of the contents of her bag. "We ought to get a few more here," she said sadly. "It's not right, a coven of 3.
"I didn't know we were still a coven. No one told me we were still a coven," sniffed Granny Weatherwax. "Anyway, there's no one else this side of the mountain excepting old Gamma Dismas, and she doesn't get out these days."
"But a lot of young girls in my village," said McGrath. "You know, they could be keen."
"That's not how we do it, as well you know," said Granny disapprovingly. "People don't go out and find witchcraft. It comes and finds them."
"Yes, yes," said McGrath. "Sorry."
"Right," said Granny, slightly mollified.
She'd never mastered the talent for apologizing, but she appreciated it in other people.
about this new duke, then, said Nanny, to lighten the atmosphere.
Granny sat back.
He had some houses burned down in Badass, she said, because of taxes.
How horrible, said McGrath.
Old King Varence used to do that, said Nanny. Terrible temper he had. He used to let people get out first, though, said Granny. Oh, yes, said Nanny, who was a staunch royalist. He could be very gracious like that. He pay for them to be rebuilt as often as not, if he remembered. And every hog's watch night, a side of venison, regular, said Granny wistfully. Oh, yes, very respectful to witches he was, added Nanny Og. When he was out hunting people, if he met me in the woods, it was always off with his helmet, and I hopes I finds you well, Mistress Og. And next day he'd send his butler down with a couple of bottles or something. He was a proper king.